It's Dig Deep on KEXE KBXE. We have conversation once a month with our commentators, Aaron Brown. He is our liberal commentator, and Chuck Marrone, our conservative. And we're talking impeachment. In this segment, modern impeachment. Where do we begin now?
Well, now we have the imperial presidency. You know, I think there's many ways to look at this. I drew in an earlier segment the Wilson line.
Maybe Teddy Roosevelt.
Maybe Teddy Roosevelt. I think you could draw it either way. Teddy Roosevelt certainly was sympathetic to the imperial aspects of the Wilson administration, World War I. But basically, as soon as you start mobilizing troops in world wars, and then I think accelerating once we got the atomic bomb, and the whole nuclear age, and we had to be able to make split-second decisions about life or death of literally millions of people, power became naturally consolidated in one person. And we've seen in successive administrations, ever since really Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, this consolidation of power in the executive to now where I think that if we went back to the Andrew Johnson days and looked at, you know, well, I don't agree with the Congress, I'm going to do it this way. I don't know if there's even a debate at this point. I mean, I think the executive just does what they want.
Well, the last several presidents, Congress has learned that they can try to stop a president, and a president learns ways to use modern media, the bully pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt called it, the ability to kind of work external of Congress to shape the will of, that they want. And of course, the public has, I think, come to demand a president to deliver something that they want. And to blame presidents for things like Great Depressions and things that happen that they don't like. And so the president therefore feels that they must act. And so all of these things combine to make a, you know, a system where it's in a president's interest to try to get around Congress, to force Congress to do what they want. And if they won't, to make it a problem for Congress or to do try to do it themselves through executive action.
See, you get Richard Nixon, who, I mean, let's give the most generous interpretation, had paranoia issues, was like an old boss party insider in the days of, you know, throw some elbows.
Mm-hmm. He's a Shakespearean figure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's a Richard III kind of Machiavellian product, which is unfortunate because, and this is the liberal talking, looking back historically, you could look at him and say, there's a man who could have been a beloved president.
From a governing standpoint, did some amazing things.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, things that even liberals could enjoy.
Like
the clean air and water bills, which he signed.
He actually was not a very conservative, you know, fiscal manager of the economy. He's most known for opening up China.
Right. The bill that he proposed for healthcare, to extend healthcare coverage, was, I'm not saying it's exactly like, but it almost entirely mirrors what Obamacare would decades later become.
In my world.
In fact, it might have been more liberal because there was a public option in Nixon's bill.
Yeah. In my professional realm, he actually commissioned a report called The Cost of Sprawl, which I think dealt with the underlying financial insolvency of the post-war development pattern and was roundly ignored and ridiculed.
I've got one more. My colleague at the college, the history professor, Steve Potts, told me he went to a Dakota tribal meeting in South Dakota, I believe, and he was amazed in the tribal council that there was a giant portrait of Richard Nixon hanging in there. And it's because, say what you will about Nixon, he agreed to new sovereignty rules that gave tribal governments more sovereignty, despite all of his many flaws and the things that would ultimately drive him from office. So I think we can stop the Richard Nixon love fest now and say that despite all of these positives that could have made a great transcendental president out of the man, he was power hungry, paranoid, and
kept enemies lists.
And he kept
talked
enemies
openly
lists. Yeah.
of things. And so if you're going to be generous, he didn't know that people were doing break-ins and burglaries on his behalf. I have to imagine he wouldn't have been totally surprised by it,
right,
just because of the culture of people that he seemed to surround himself with and the conversations. Nonetheless, this break-in happens. He is, if not active in covering up, certainly acquiescent in covering it up. And this is revealed in a series of informants,
right,
and other leaks, and then ultimately congressional testimony. There's really three charges brought against him in impeachment: obstruction of justice, abuse of power, contempt of Congress. And they're all related. Obstruction of justice is you try to do a cover-up. basically. They're trying to investigate this and you tried to cover it up. Abuse of power is you use your office as part of this cover up. Like you use the power of the presidency to make this happen. And then contempt of Congress is you refused to work with us when we were doing what we were supposed to do as a Congress, which is get to the bottom of this and have checks and balances.
Yeah, you edited your tapes, you altered evidence, you withheld evidence.
So the funny thing is, was any of this a crime? I think that that's been one of these. He was pardoned, I think, by Gerald Ford to kind of get rid of that. That was never fully resolved. Talk about high crimes and misdemeanors. Certainly there were crimes that occurred and people went to prison as a result of the Watergate break-in and everything. But did Richard Nixon himself commit a crime? I've seen it argued very credibly both ways. As crazy as the president is incapable of committing a crime because the president is, in a sense,
is above the law.
Above the law. Yeah.
Which is an actual argument that is actually still it being interpreted as the law of the land today.
Right. And to other things where if the president takes a paperclip without noting it in the proper ledger, it's a theft of government property. So this is stuff that's not clear and open for a lot of interpretation. I think what was very clear and obviously became clear to both parties, because Nixon, this power hungry person, gave up power. Because he was going to have it stripped from him very inelegantly, it became clear that he had abused his office for his own, aggrandizement, for his own power. He had overstepped the bounds of what even a modern presidency we could accept.
And he became convinced that as a private citizen, he could protect his legacy better and could withhold his evidence that he wanted to hold on his tapes. That he wanted to hold on to. That was a key part of his decision to resign.
So how far did it get in Congress? When did he resign?
Well, it was articles of impeachment were raised in the House. Much like today, the House committee held its early preliminary trial, and the committee had voted on articles of impeachment to advance to the House. And that is the moment in time when President Nixon made the decision to resign.
So he was never impeached.
It never passed the House.
Never passed the House. So there was no trial in the Senate, but he could see the writing on the wall. This is different than William Jefferson Clinton, Bill Clinton, who was impeached.
Right. And it went all the way through the process.
Yep. And basically, Clinton, there's a bunch of different charges, but there's basically two main things. First, he lied to the grand jury concerning Monica Lewinsky and the whole investigation of him that had... I think this is interesting in the context of Donald Trump's tax returns and a lot of these other things that are coming to play now. There was alleged that Bill Clinton did a bunch of things before he became president, that once he got in the public spotlight and this high profile, people who had access to power, whether it was prosecutorial power or what have you, were able to, in a sense, be, I'm going to say, gnats snipping at the president. And ultimately forced him into having to sit down for an affidavit. He lied in that affidavit as various. He ultimately lost his law license when he was no longer president because of it. The charges brought to him were basically back then in those days, you obstructed justice, you lied, and you now, in a sense, in our trying to discover what actually in the courts, the law's case to try to figure this out. You used your office inappropriately to obstruct that investigation. The Republican House said, yes, all that is true. That did happen. He did all those things.
So they impeached him, and quite literally they passed it, and that meant that it was advanced to the United States Senate for a trial. And like with Andrew Johnson, you need two-thirds to pass. And I wish I was better. I wish I remembered what the votes were on the different articles of impeachment.
My recollection, I didn't look up the numbers, but my recollection is it wasn't even in debate. It wasn't even close.
Yeah. And it was it entirely partisan? There was a few senators that switched. Lieberman.
There was a little bit of crossover.
Yeah. A few senators switched sides on that, but it was nowhere close to, not like Johnson's one vote. It was never really had a chance of passing after the trial was held. And so Clinton was not convicted, and which meant he was not removed from power. It bears mentioning, too, that the Senate has options if they do convict on the punishment. They could for instance, not remove a president. They could remove a president. They could remove a president and legally prevent that person from running for office again. And none of those are prescribed. They get to choose.
So I feel like, and I'd like your interpretation too, of the Clinton impeachment. My sense is that none of the things that he did, and he clearly did, I'm not a Bill Clinton fan. Bill Clinton could not be president today in the post-Me Too era.
I agree with that.
Yeah, he would not get past the primary. He's in many ways a genius politician and very skilled public policy person. There's a lot of those in the United States today that don't have the deep personal flaws that Bill Clinton has. But my sense is at the time, and as someone who watched this whole thing and was really deep into it and printed out the whole Kenneth Starr report and went through it and felt, you know, as a very young man kind of vested in seeing the end of this terrible person, I look at it in retrospect as there's a lot of people who thought Bill Clinton was unworthy of the presidency and that he should be gone. None of this really has to deal with anything that was either unknown or like surprising about his character when he was elected twice to the presidency.
Right.
None of this actually had to deal with his capacity to be president or his execution of his office. It's very different than Andrew Johnson in that sense.
Yeah.
And so it's been described by people who were against it as, you know, a political witch hunt or using politics.
Partisan.
Very partisan to go after someone that they didn't like. And in retrospect, it's kind of hard to see that not having been the case, even though I'm not a Bill Clinton apologist or fan.
So looking back at it from my point of view, a young liberal engaged, involved in political organization for the Democratic Party at the time in college, and I look back on it, and I remember what I thought at the time, which was, you mentioned witch hunt. I don't believe I used that terminology, but I said, well, it's a person's personal relationship. Why should it affect their professional job is being elected president of the United States? Why would this matter? My goodness, you know, if name the Kennedy, if any of the presidents who were known, we now know to have had extramarital affairs, if they were all prosecuted in the same way, we wouldn't have any presidents at all, you know, and all this. I was very much seeing it through a partisan lens and with a lot of cultural assumptions about the behavior that was normal at the time. And that was the hypocrisy of it was, despite Bill Clinton's behavior, which we can, I think, agree was bad in terms of his relationships with women and his cover-up of those relationships and his relationships with subordinates. But that was happening all over politics at the time. Many of the people who voted for impeachment would later get caught up in their own scandals and travails of the same kind of nature. So very, very hypocritical, it seemed at the time. But I have to admit, and sitting here now, we look back and you mentioned that it was very partisan. It's hard not to see it through that lens. I completely agree because it was unlike Johnson and somewhat unlike Nixon. We are now in the realm of something that was so partisan motivation for starting it. Bill Clinton was just offensive because of his partisanship, because to partisans of the other stripe. He was popular in the country. His approval rating went up during impeachment, which is an example you hear now. Like, well, let's see if Trump's popularity goes up as he's being impeached. Yeah, we'll see. I think the climate is different and we'll see. But it was the beginning of the Constitution as a partisan tool rather than a governing philosophy for our country where high-minded people, you might be a Republican, I might be a Democrat, but we believe in the Constitution. And I'm not, it sounds a little mocking, but I mean,
no,
like,
I think you're exactly right.
You know, where like, okay, we all come together. The kind of the West Wing Constitution, the show West Wing, where I know I've triggered alert, Chuck.
The liberal utopian.
The liberal utopian, where the president, in a moment of crisis, turns power over to the other party because it's the right thing to do constitutionally. And we live in this, which is a fantasy, because it would never be allowed to happen in our reality now, which is a partisan reality, which is all about having power now, and if you don't have it now, do everything within your ability to get it in the next election or to get it in the next term of the Supreme Court or whatever the case may be.
Let me give you what I think is the current equivalent to Bill Clinton, and that would be Donald Trump's tax returns. There's a
pre-existing condition. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, there's a group of people that from the day he got the Republican nomination have been interested in his tax returns. And I am here to tell you, I'm here to attest that if you take a person who is a multi-billionaire, who has international dealings in all kinds of real estate and what have you, if you comb through a decade of his tax returns, you're going to find things that are questionable. Mm-hmm. Even if that person is upstanding, even if that person has followed all the rules,
you're going to find things that can be used against that.
You're going to find things that at the end of the day, an IRS agent might look at and say, you avoided taxes here. You should have paid this. And they'll be arguable. But that's the nature of our tax code. Our tax code is such that if you start racking up deductions and weird things, you're gonna cross into questionable ground.
But there is also the possibility and the likelihood that it's not all of what Trump has said is true.
Granted.
You know, and that's the thing, is matching what he said he has versus all that versus what he actually did.
But I think the question about that is that political or is that criminal? So the idea here is, let's get some friendly jurisdiction, the same way we got friendly jurisdictions to prosecute Paula Jones and, you know, all these other things against Bill Clinton. Let's create a honey trap, you know, where we can get someone to give something under oath that we can then go back and say, look, they lied. Clearly they lied. And now we gotcha. And to me, that's what was done to Bill Clinton. And that's what the whole concept of the tax returns is on Donald Trump.
But the tax returns is not what brought us to this particular spot.
No, but I'm drawing the parallel.
Right.
Because I think that there are people probably listening.
You could have, like, on those grounds, Democrats the Congress when Trump was first elected, they could have impeached him if they wanted to on the tax return issue. They could have.
Sure.
They didn't.
They did, right. But the idea was that just like Republicans, the machine behind built this case against Clinton with the sex harassment. You know, there's a machine right now on the left that has been building this case against Donald Trump about tax returns. And to me, those are like equivalent things in the mechanism being used. You may, as a very partisan person, go, I think Bill Clinton's disgusting and all his stuff with women should have gotten removed from office. Fine. Agreed. Like, that's fine. And you may say Donald Trump is corrupt and all this, the fact that he won't release his tax returns creates this whole mystery around it. And there's certainly stuff in there we can go after. He's discussing, get rid of him. Fine. Those are both, in a sense, after the fact. And I used the term witch hunt before. I would use the same term for the tax return thing.
Well, a witch hunt is looking for things that aren't there.
But Bill Clinton did. I mean, I've got the 11 counts. He actually did all these things.
Sure, no.
Right?
So that, therefore, you can argue that, you know, the question is whether those were at the time. At the time, I would have said, no, they don't amount to an impeachment argument. When I was 18, 19 years old and a liberal Democrat working in the party. We can argue now, I mean, maybe how we feel differently. I feel differently about Clinton in general because, not because of the politics or even the legality of it, but because of my changing attitudes about how people should be treated and how public officials should behave. That's just my own personal experience.
Would you impeach Clinton today?
I think Clinton should have resigned for his actions.
Yeah, but he wasn't going to. Would you? Because I would not have voted to impeach him today. But maybe, you know, that's my...
Interesting.
You would have.
Okay, we're going to keep this conversation going in the podcast only edition.
We didn't even get to the rest of it.
No, you're going to have to listen to our podcast only. You can get it through the iTunes podcast or available on our website, kaxe.org. Dig Deep, Chuck Marone, and Aaron Brown. I also want to remind you, live Dig Deep event. You can meet these guys.
Yay.
Coming up on Tuesday, December 10th at the Rife Center. The event begins at 7 o'clock. And we'll have kind of, you'll get to see this kind of conversation going on. We're using Chuck's new book. It's kind of a congratulatory thing. We'll use that as the beginning of the conversation, and then audience can be involved as well. And we hope that you will join us. It's free and open to the public at the Rife Center. You can call us if you need more information. 800-662-5799.